I am here. My favorite part of the week. I love getting to talk to you people that care about food. So here's what we're going to do. We're having kind of a brainy show today. I hope you're ready for get your brainy thinking caps on. Maybe you're inside doing inside things in the rain and ready to have some big thoughts about small microflora. So all people have been talking. It's been very much a thing in food the last year or two. Everybody's talking about, I don't want to say bacteria because that's not quite what I mean, but all the things that can give food flavor in fermentation that are not just yeast. So I always kind of like to think starting with, you know, the yeast that come in that Red Star yeast packet. And then you know what that bread tastes like. Then you know what sourdough bread tastes like. It's different, right? There's a whole bunch of different flavors. Well, this is what a lot of people in food are very, very interested about today. And so I've got two of the leaders in all this. I've got Nico Tonks from Fair State. We're going to talk about all of this regarding beer. And then later on the show, I'm going to have Jody Olson Reed, a friend of the show. She's runs Shepherd's Way Farm down in Nerstrand, that big, big deal cheesemaker. They make beautiful blue cheese. They win a lot of national awards. They're at all the farmers market. I think of them as our neighbors who have sheep. And Jody's going to join us and talk about what wild yeast and what bacteria, microflora, all these little critters, what they do for cheese. So we're having a big brain show about the tiniest creatures who help us in our food production. So that's what we're doing. And I'll have some beer recipes later on. And of course, I will answer your questions. I have some fun ones already about what is lasagna really? What is it really? Well, you're going to have to wait till the end of the show to find out my thoughts on that one. So first off, I'm very excited that we've got Nico Tonks right here with me. He's from Fair State Brewing. This is the brewing cooperative that anybody can join. You become a member. I like the organization, the way it works. I like the beer even more. They have one of the, like, pretty much my favorite beer festival. Don't tell anyone. I do play favorites. My favorite beer festival of the year is called Mix Culture. And what's cool about it is it's about these wild beers. As you know, I'm a wine snob. I like things that are interesting. And this is, to my mind, the most interesting beers are these sour beers, wild culture beers, these interesting. They're not all sour. I feel like when I talk to sour beer novices, sometimes people are like, oh, no, I had one and it was so sour. Like, they're not all like that. You might have had a sour one. But like, if you go to Belgium. There's all kinds of different flavors that come from these other yeasts that we don't always use. And some of them can be floral flavors, or they can be very delicate, but, you know, kind of like it's a butter muffin. Like, what's that about? Those are wild yeasts. Anyway, so they're having their mixed culture festival. They're bringing in different brewers from around the country next weekend. If you want to nerd out about these wild critters, this is the place to do it. And it'll be next weekend. You can find tickets. If you just hear this, you're like, oh, my goodness, I need tickets right now. Fairstate.coop. But now we're going to talk about all of this, and we'll talk more about the festival later. So, Nico, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's just kind of get into this. I think I am confused about certain aspects of the wild yeast, wild microflora, wild bacteria, whatever they are, movement versus the store-bought yeast. So why don't you break it down from your perspective? What would you tell someone you just met on a plane? What's the difference between traditional and the stuff you do?
So it's really interesting because the stuff you're talking about, the stuff we do, is in a way just as traditional or more traditional than standard beer making.
Oh, that's a good point. So if I was a monk from 1521, I'd recognize what you're doing and not what Budweiser's doing. That makes sense.
Well, you'd recognize them as the same process, but we've just learned more about microorganisms between then and now. So the reason that most beer is made with Saccharomyces, which is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is the yeast that we use for almost all beer. The reason that almost all beer is made using it is that it's extremely well suited to making beer. So over time, people sort of unintentionally and intentionally selected for that yeast because it did what they wanted it to do.
So that's one strain of yeast. And if I, like, you know, I go to work for Budweiser, I can buy that by the pallet.
Well, it's one type of yeast, and there's many different strains as subsets. And in fact, so we talk about ale yeast and lager yeast. And so there are different types of yeast that fit into the sort of the quote-unquote clean beer segment that people will refer to as just sort of like the beer that we drink day in, day out.
Okay, so the beer we drink day in, day out, like I want to start a massive beer factory. Money's no object. I sit down. I'm like, we're going to have a lager, an ale, a porter. And then I just open a book and I'm like, get me 30 pounds of that porter yeast and 30 pounds of whatever. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's what everybody does. That's what we do.
Everybody does. And that's what you do.
Yeah. So there are a number of labs out there that have done, you know, a really good job of isolating yeast strains from different breweries, yeasts with known characteristics. So say, for example, we make a lot of lagers at Fair State. The lager yeast that we use is from the Augustiner Brewery in Munich. So
Did they let you have it?
Well, it ended up in a yeast lab in Colorado, and we buy it from them. So some people are pretty secretive about yeasts. So Budweiser, for example, the story goes their yeast is delivered from brewery to brewery under police escort because it's top secret stuff.
Sounds like a basis for a good movie where robbers make a mistake. But go on.
A very low dollar theft.
Exactly. Yeah. Open up the boxes at home. And you're like, oh.
Yeah. But a lot of people are pretty open about this. And the fact of the matter is yeast ends up in the final beer. So say somebody, you know, buys a bottle of Fair State, a mixed firm beer, a sour beer that they really like. They want to make that beer. Well, the good news is the dregs at the bottom of the bottle contain all of the microorganisms that we use to make that beer. So if you can give it – it's like feeding a sourdough starter. If you can give it good food, you will get those organisms to grow up again, and then you can use them yourself.
But a lot of breweries like sterilize, filter, do other things to keep that from happening?
So these days, increasingly, that doesn't happen. I mean, most beer that ends up on the shelf that's going to be, you know, IPA or whatever that's sitting in the cooler, for the most part, you know, people have made – good faith effort to remove the yeast from that for shelf stability reasons. But very few, with the exception of very large brewers, are either pasteurizing or sterile filtering anything anymore. So yeast is around.
Yeast is around. Okay. That'll be our theme for the show. It is around. It's on our skin right now. Okay. So back to what you do, what everybody does. So you say like, oh, I'm going to make an ale, call up the lab. I get some of special ale yeast airmailed. So what is the difference between what you do then and what everybody does?
Well, I mean, I think that the difference is
I've trapped you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm trying to think of the best way to put it. Because I think that people sometimes we get hung up on process. And process is really important. But so if we're making pills, you know, clean lager beer, or if we're making like Lactobac, for example, which is this lemon, ginger, lemongrass mixed firm sour beer that takes 12
weeks. So Lactobac is one of these wild kind of beers that we'll be trying at Mixed Culture. And
right.
It's kind of an example of, you know, as regular bread is to sourdough, regular beer is to lactobac. Lactobac is your signature thing that has wild bacteria in it or used wild beasties to get to that flavor.
It's got all sorts of stuff in it. But you know, the process of making them is very, very similar. We make wort that has the characteristics that we want for the finished beer, and then we add yeast to it.
Okay, so wort, people don't know, like that's just the Cheerios and water mix. Like that's the grain and the water together. That's what it all starts at. Okay, so
yeah. So the story goes that brewers make wort. We spend all day slaving away our machinery to make fancy sugar water, and that yeast makes beer. So, you know, I think to the point, yeast makes beer. Different yeast is going to make different kinds of beer. So, like, pills would just be lager yeast, and then it goes through its thing. Lactobac, we pitch a Saison yeast, which is a type of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. We pitch some Brettanomyces, which is a quote-unquote wild yeast. And then we pitch a whole gamut of different acid-producing microbes. So different lactobacillus strains, Pediococcus, which is another lactic acid-producing organism. And then those things, we refer to that as a mixed culture. So it's a whole bunch of different bugs working in conjunction.
Is this analogous to, you know, if I'm going to make soup, I'm going to put chicken in it and I might put some peppercorns, maybe some parsnips. Like, are all of the way that you're using bacteria is the same way that I would build flavor in a soup by using different elements? Is that analogous to?
Kind of, sort of, except that we're also making soup. Like, quite literally, we're making barley soup. And there's a whole bunch of flavor elements that come from that as well. So in the example of this particular beer, you're getting all the acid is coming from these microorganisms. Okay, so there's that. And
okay,
then,
so just for people. So when the bacteria, like, they, you know, lead their lives and they excrete acid. That's why yogurt turns sour. That's an example.
Yep. And this is actually a lot of the very same species that you would use in yogurt. So it's lactic acid in this case. There's a bunch of different kinds of acid. If we were to add fruit, if it was citrus, we'd be getting a whole bunch of citric acid, and that would give us one character. But in this case, we're looking for lactic acid, which is a pretty soft, round, palatable, not super harsh acid.
Right. And so everybody wants lactic acid. Winemakers want it. They add the bacteria that create, they call it malolactic fermentation to get those things that give it a nice tartness, because a wine without tartness it just feels flabby and terrible in the glass. So that's something you're adding.
Yep. And that's actually a really good example, because that malolactic fermentation, they're using lactobacillus to move malic acid, which is very harsh, to lactic acid, which is less harsh. So it just goes to show why we're after this lactic acid. It's the one that everybody wants. So that's where we're getting acid from. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the flavors in the finished beer come from non-biological things that we're putting in there, like lemongrass, like ginger. So we're making soup on the one hand, and then we're really trying to figure out, say, for example, the right cooking technique for that soup. So you have the raw ingredients, and then you have the cooking part. And to us, the fermentation is more analogous, perhaps, to the cooking part of the thing.
When I was just a baby wine critic and trying to get my head around things, I'd always talk to winemakers, and they'd be like, and I used 1%, you know, Pinot Nero, and that was changes to everything. And my first instinct was very skeptical. I was like, how can 1% of anything make that big a difference? And then people were like, well, think about, you know, when you make soup, you put 1% of cayenne, that's going to make a difference. I was like, oh, okay. I kind of get my head around this. So you must have a reason to add each of these little micro dudes that you're adding.
Yeah, we do. And I think a lot of the time what happens with sour beer is that it gets put in this black box, and the words like wild and spontaneous get thrown around a lot. And what that kind of does is it gives brewers an excuse to not understand what's happening. But it also creates this air of mystery around it, which is sometimes useful. But, you know, I think that it's important for us as producers to understand, you know, at least roughly what's happening in this fermentation. And so our barrel culture contains multitudes. It's got all sorts of different acid producers and yeasts in there. And I couldn't tell you to a one what exactly they all are, but I understand the major players and I know what they're doing. And
you maintain at Fair State, you know, kind of the same way people keep a sourdough starter, you keep a certain amount of this kind of slurry from the bottom of a good batch of beer that you can then just keep moving around, move forward.
Yeah, and you have to kind of point it in the right direction over generations, because we get genetic drift actually very quickly, because yeast reproduces so fast that you have multiple generations in one fermentation. And so you do end up having this genetic drift. And so you have to push it back in the direction that you want it to go, either by starting over or adding some culture that you know is predictable. But, you know, I think we can manipulate the environment that the yeast and microorganisms do their work in by making different wort, like a different substrate, essentially. But also we can manipulate the final product by selecting what organisms go in. So if we're looking for like extra super funk, or if we're looking for like a really sort of lemony kind of thing, you know, we would go a couple different directions for those two different things.
That's very interesting. And so this festival that you're having next weekend is called Mixed Culture. It's happening at your original tap room. So it's smaller than versions you've done before. And you've got people coming from around the country. Suarez Family Brewery from Livingston, Threes Brewing from Brooklyn, You know, Forager from Rochester. People don't get down there very much. Funk Factory, Madison, Wisconsin. I mean, just it's kind of a who's who. So what is, you know, you know more about this than anyone. What do you get? What are the flavor differences? What's going to happen at Mixed Culture that I'm going to walk around and I'm going to taste different beers? And what am I going to be experiencing?
So it's actually on the 16th, which I think is 16th. Two weeks from now.
2 weeks from now. Oh, sorry. Thank
right?
you.
I think. Anyway,
right.
So we're super excited about this. I think this is – we've seen this as a trend nationally where breweries will throw beer festivals. And what you end up with is a really well-curated list of producers. And in this case, it just so happens to be almost exclusively people that we know personally or people that we've admired for a really long time and went out on a limb and invited them and they said yes. So I think what you're going to see is a really, really wide gamut of different palates. Because so you mentioned Suarez family first. Dan Suarez was a brewer at Hill Farmstead in New York, which is a very famous brewery. And he has a very particular vision for every beer that he makes. And I really admire what they do because they're very good at not straying from that vision. So his beers are all very stripped down, very simple, very pointed, very well put together. So you're going to – and they're bringing lager beer and they're bringing sour beer. We basically told everybody to bring their favorite stuff. Whatever it is, just bring it. So, you know, if you walk over to them and you talk to Dan, who's going to be there, and say – and just drink pills and then drink some of their what they call country beer side by side, I think it's a really nice through line where you can learn something about that brewer. And we've got friends coming from Texas. Jester King will be there. And for them, it's all about place. So their beers always involve as many local ingredients as is humanly possible. So there's going to be, you know, you sit there and learn something about the Texas Hill Country. Ditto Fonta Flora from Morganton, North Carolina. Another friend of mine who works there. They actually, their big festival is next weekend. It's called State of Origin. And they do crazy things with local fruit, and they make kvass.
Because local fruit comes with its own wrapping of interesting bacteria.
Totally.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be a good time. At the end of the day, it's a beer festival. It's there for drinking beer. It's going to be fun. But also, I think it's going to be I'm really looking forward to just walking around and drinking all these beers and learning things, too.
That's what I like. I like this idea that it's a taste test. And this may not be for everyone, but as a foodie person, I have had a lot of these experiences in my life. Tasting 30 gins, and that's incredibly difficult. Or tasting, you know, 20 olive oils, tasting, 40 chocolates sort of side by side. And it can be very fatiguing, like mentally, like you feel like you're learning a new language, but so interesting. And you learn so much. And I find that when I go through one of these experiences at the afterwards, like it all starts to piece together in my mind, and like I learned so much sort of after it. So I'm excited that you're bringing all of this here. I think this is a big deal. I love all of these kind of wild and sour beers, and they're not all sour. So don't tell me that you had one and it was too sour, and now you hate them all, because that's not I'm going to make you try some more.
It's not allowed.
I have rules. All right. Well, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. But Nico Ferris. State Co-op. If you want to find more about this Mixed Culture Festival, I have a blog up at mspmag.com all about it. I will tweet that out yet again, mspmag.com. And you can also find all the details, buy tickets, everything, fairstate.coop. It is June 16th, so 2 weeks from tomorrow. It's just very cool. All right, Nico, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we come back. I'm going to talk to Jody from Shepherd's Way in Nørstrand. We're going to talk about bacteria and cheese, and that's going to be cool. Dara here. Yeah, we're talking about one of the things that's very big in food right now. It's hard to get your head around, but all of these food makers, people that make sauerkraut, kimchi, bread, beer, as we just heard, all kinds of people are thinking about the wild and less tamed, you know, ways to get fermented foods to have more flavor, bigger oomph. I have the great cheesemaker, Jody Olson-Reed, on the line. She is the first guest we ever had on Off the Menu and a really big friend of the show. And she's the only person I know who has hundreds of views. So I thought I would talk to her. She's got big beasts on her farm and little beasts in the cheesemaking room. microscopically small beast to help make that cheese taste good. And Jody is on the phone. Jody, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. All right, first I got to get the update. How are things going on the farm?
They're good. It's busy. We're just finishing another round of lambing, so that means more ewes are joining the milking parlor. So lots of milk and lots of cheese making going on.
Oh, very cool. And so the sheep and the lambs are all just standing around in the pasture looking cute?
They are loving the weather today, nice and cool. They like to move around and eat when it's not hot and sunny.
Yeah, that's me. I do that too. I like to move around and eat when it's
me too.
All right, so help us understand I know that in Europe, you know, the fancy cheesemakers, places like Roquefort, they attribute much of their success to the microflora that just kind of live around the famous caves. Talk to me about microflora and cheesemaking in the world of Shepherd's Way.
Well, for us, we love our microflora. They play a role in the actual making of the cheese. We add starter bacteria that help acidify the milk and get things going. And we also add bacteria that are called adjunct bacteria that help add aromas and flavors. And then once the cheese is made, we have another microbiome on the outside of the cheese where there are yeasts and molds and bacteria that work together to create the kind of finish on the cheese that we're looking for. So we have a bunch of worlds to manage, and we try to provide the things that those little critters need to grow and manage the ones that we don't want growing. So,
and then, of course, everybody's familiar with blue cheese. That's a whole, when the blue part, that's something else.
Yes, the blue mold powder that's added to the milk helps create the blue that you see inside your cheese. We also have to create airways in there that we do by piercing it because the mold needs air to grow. So if you don't pierce it, that mold doesn't grow in there. And there are also things that can get in the way of those molds growing. If you have certain yeasts and things that get into your cheese or the environment, it can get in the way of that blue growing, and then it doesn't.
I think a lot of people have seen that. Sometimes you'll see a slice of blue cheese and it'll have just, you know, very symmetrical lines. And that's piercing with a tool,
yep,
of some sort to make a space for the blue molds to get air.
Exactly. And all of these little critters need the right acidity in their environment, the right amount of water, air to feed them so that they can grow. And we add things to the outside and to the milk, but there are also microflora that are just in your environment, that are in your air, and they add a unique aspect to your cheese that reflects your specific environment if you let them show up. So,
okay, I want to talk to you about that, but let me just add one more so the people that don't know. When you see something like a brie or a camembert and it has that nice bloomy exterior, that's not like frosting. What is that?
That's another mold and sometimes a yeast that grow and work together. It's either a Penicillium camberti or a Penicillium candidum that make the white fluff. And sometimes you see the cheese that's kind of brainy looking.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a yeast. That's a Geotrichium candidum, another yeast. And those two can often work together to create the kind of felted mold that you want to see on the outside.
Okay, so you are an esteemed cheesemaker. You're one of our country's best cheesemakers. You have all kinds of gold medals to prove it. When you're thinking about making cheese, you know, so you have these different options, right? You have a catalog of different yeasts and molds that you could buy. Tell me how you kind of arrive at the flavor profiles. Just kind of walk us through it.
Well, you can start with the recipe the way you would with, say, taco chip cookies. You can start with a recipe and then start tweaking it. Most of the time I start with what do I want it to be like in the end and which bacterias and flavors are going to get me there along with the techniques. So same way with a recipe, you might try it one time and say this needs a little something, so you go a different direction. My most recent cheese that we have is called Sogan, and that one I really wanted to reflect our farm, more like a a farmer cheese, a Tome or a Toma. So I let the exterior of that one grow a more varied assortment of molds on the outside so we could see what grows here most readily.
So how much of what I taste, what I'm tasting Shepherd's Way, is from your farm, from Minnesota? Is this native, you know, what we in wine we call it terroir, it's the flavor of the place. So obviously there's the flavor of the place that comes from the milk, right, from the ewes eating the lovely southern Minnesota grass. Like there's those flavors, but then what's the bacterial component that is native to here?
Well, that's a whole area that's just really starting to be studied more intensively. Benjamin Wolf is one of the scientists that's leading that, and Jasper Hill is another cheese maker that is working in that area where we're really starting to explore what are some of the native bacteria and molds and yeasts to each area. So here, like you said, the milk is the canvas, and what our sheep eat affects the milk. So that comes through in a real subtle ways. There are certain molds that are more common in different areas. So some of the more subtle flavors from the affinage, from the finishing, are what would reflect the farm. Someday I hope to be able to tell you all of the specific names, but it's a really new area of research.
So the affinage, that's what the fancy French term that means, kind of all the stuff that you do towards the end of the process, right?
Exactly. So if there are molds growing on your cheese that they're getting too carried away and you want to tame them down, we brush them to kind of, you knock down their environment. So there are different things, flipping and washing and changing the temperature and monitoring the moisture in the air. Those are all parts of the affinage or the finishing of the cheese.
And I think a lot of people may be familiar with this from the cheese counter. Like you go and you look and this one is beer washed cheese or this one is a whiskey washed cheese. And so those techniques have two end products, right? So one is you get the flavor of the beer or the whiskey, and the other is it changes the bacteria?
Yes, or you could be adding yeast, too, when you're adding, washing it with beer. It's a lot of different aspects to manage, but it can really lend a lot more depth to the cheeses. And plus, it's fun.
So if people want to start kind of exploring this in their own lives and learning a little more about how this is, talk to me about, what are some strategies? How should you go around tasting?
I would maybe start with categories. You could either do cow, sheep, goat, or you could start with washed rinds or natural rinds. Going to a cheese counter where they cut off the wheel and they will let you sample, and that they're knowledgeable and can explain, that's a really simple, fun way. The American Cheese Society has a great website with some resources, and you just start out with what you're drawn to, and there's just a wealth of information now about where the cheeses come from. And if you really want to get into the science of it, there are some good websites. Cheesescience.org has some good technical information about the cheese making.
And so are there, so I know that this is, from talking to you about other things, that this is a, something that you've been drawn to. One of the things that makes cheese making exciting for you is that this is a field of knowledge that kind of one of those things where the more you get into it, the more there is to learn and the more there is to change. Can you talk to me about one or two of your cheeses that your kind of use of microflora has changed since you started the creamery?
The Frisago would be the best example. It's coming up on the 20-year birthday of Frisago this fall.
Wow, when it can go to college.
Exactly. It could start earning a living, right? So it started as a wax cheese because that was the fashion of the time. People weren't really ready for some of the wilder-looking rinds that had lots of beautiful colors and things. Over time, we evolved that cheese as customers became more excited about different cheese finishes. We changed that to be a natural rinded cheese, and that means that I don't wax it. We wash it with brine, a salt water, for the first couple of weeks, and then we let it develop some interesting molds and yeasts on the outside before it's done aging. The first phase of that, we cleaned it off really thoroughly before it went out to the world, so it looked more like a stone on the outside. Now, in the last year or so, we've let more of the beautiful flora grow and go out with the cheese, so it's a little more colorful, a little more interesting looking, and it has more depth of flavor. So that one has had the most dramatic changes.
And is that because you just made a decision like you're gonna enjoy what I enjoy, world, or is it because there's more literacy out there and people are more willing to you know, interact with cheeses that are not, you know, very geometrical?
Definitely because consumers are more excited. That was, you know, if I make something I think is really beautiful and nobody wants to buy it, well, that's not going to work. So it's a combination. And as I became more comfortable with cheese making and learned more, I was able to take it in a new direction and see what happened with it. And I wanted to see if I could make it even better with more depth. So it was definitely a combination of the consumer desires and just doing the same thing for a long time and seeing what else you could do with it.
Oh, that's fascinating. All right. So if you want to find out more, Jody, where are y'all this weekend at the farmers markets?
Today we are at the Mill City Farmers Market and at the St. Paul Farmers Market until 1 o'clock.
All right. And if you want to, they're there very often. One of my absolute favorites, and your cheeses are at a lot of different stores. I know I can get them at Kowalski's and other places. And you can always find everything you're up to at shepherdswayfarms.com, right? Is that it?
Very good, yes.
All right, Jody, thank you. I'm very interested in this. We're all going to pursue this exciting field of tiny microscopic critters helping us find delicious things to eat. I think this is going to be the trend for a couple of years now, so I appreciate your helping me understand. So thank you.
It's always fun to talk about cheese with you, and if anybody would like to come down to the farm in July, we have an open house on July 14th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Oh, and you can see the sheep. They're so cute. They're just all puffy like they are in cartoons. I love them. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You have a good one. I will come back, and we're going to talk about cooking with beer. What if you've been kind of just can't stop buying cool beers, and then you want to move them out in more interesting ways than just drinking them? Can you make bread? I think you're going to guess the answer, but we'll have the answer when we come back. Dara here. All right, let's get through our beer recipes. They're all up at WCCORadio.com/menu. All right, so they're all up. They look good. Cooking with beer. Do you do this? Is it just my problem where you just keep buying the really cool stuff and then you kind of want to move some of it out in a different way? It's not bad. Not bad beer. It's just that you need to make room because you have a shopping problem, evidently. Come on. There's got to be someone out there who does that beside me. Okay, so here are my top 5 recipes to use up that beer. Got number 5, some beer cheese soup, of course. Here in the virtuous north, you can't say cooking with beer without mentioning beer cheese soup. Got Amy Thielen's recipe up. She is a little complicated, I grant you, but it is delicious. We should have Amy on. She's got a paperback out of the Give a Girl a Knife book, which is such a nice story, such a nice Valentine to the Northland, and how good German potato salad is up north. Talk about that some more. Number 4, beer bread. Love sourdough bread. I am not keeping a sourdough starter. I can barely keep the kitchen table clean, but I can make bread by making that no-knead recipe. You just kind of take some yeast and flour and water, pour it together. It makes a very wet dough. Well, guess what? If you use beer in place of the water, replace all the water with beer, that's a better version of that bread. Do that. Very good. Easy. Do it. Coca la bière. All right. Everyone's heard of coq au vin, right? The French version of, you know, chicken cooked in wine. Well, there's a slightly northern version from Belgium, which is chicken cooked in beer. And I have a recipe. It is up. It's a good thing to do. Very delicious. It's a beautiful brown gravy. Number two, beef carbonade. That is called pot roast cooked in beer. Good way to use any of your darker beers that you're hoping to move out. And here's a tip. A friend of mine does this. She puts her crock pot on the porch in the summer so it doesn't hot up the house. You can do that. Put a rock on the lid if you're worried about raccoons. There, that's a cooking tip you don't get every day. And my number one, of course it was going to be beer canned chicken. I was at Mercy in downtown Minneapolis a couple weeks ago, and they have a beer canned chicken that's so good. What the chef did there is he figured out a way to like spot weld a kind of a disc onto a larger disc to hold his beer can so that the thing never tips over. That is worth it. That was a good use of spot welding. Anyway, you should do that. I've got a great recipe on the inside of the web, on the inside of the internet. I don't know why I said inside there, but saving myself. On the web right now, WCCORadio.com/Dara, I believe. You can see all the recipes. Very good. All right, questions have come in. Loving my show. Thank you. And I'm loving you back. And sadly, I have a quart of very sour 2% milk ideas. You know, you can use sour milk anywhere that you would use buttermilk. So you can use it in cornbread. You can use it in pancakes. I've seen a recipe that uses it for pork. So any of those places. All right. Next week, we're jumping back 100 years. Got a granddaughter of Al Capone and a prohibition cocktail expert. And I will see you here next week with them on Off the Menu.